Welcome to the 12th episode of Season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 19th of July 2010. In this episode, we're going to talk to Joe Shields about his work on Ubuntu. We'll talk about where and how we should promote Ubuntu. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, and go over your feedback. I'm Simon, and it's the standard four at the moment. So this week, Tony.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well.
You've been on holiday?
I have. It was great.
Cool. I had 2 days off. That was quite good too. What have I been doing? I have been eBaying a load of old kit, some audio kit, some computers that I found around my house. You wouldn't believe how many computers I found when I started to poke around my house.
Did you find any of mine?
It's not a big house.
Have you sold my juggler on eBay?
No, not yet. But I'll give me a chance when I get back home.
It's amazing what people will buy.
It is, yeah. Old laptops and old PCs and
Hang
stuff.
Hang on, is this going to turn into an advert for Tony's eBay?
Come
Tony's
to
eBay store.
No. But trying to get rid of some kit, recycle it, give it to people who find it useful, make a little bit of cash if I can as well. And I've been using DBAN to wipe all the hard disks on these things. So Darik's Boot and Nuke, it stands for.
Oh, really?
But it does all sorts of Department of Defense, so presumably the US Department of Defense, standard wipes and things.
Interesting. I need some drives. Need treating with that.
Yeah. It beats hitting them with a big mallet.
that is good fun. Especially I've done that.
It's good fun, but rather reduces their retail value.
Yeah.
We seem to have a lot of hard drives.
Yeah, again, if you're interested in buying them.
We'll put a link to Tony's eBay store.
Yeah. What have you been up to, Laura?
It says in the show notes I've been moonlighting on another podcast, which isn't strictly true. I got a mention on another geeky podcast.
Which is that?
Home Camp.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, Mike's Home Camp.
Mike's Home Camp. Mike the Bee. At Mike the Bee's Home Camp podcast. Because I asked a question on the Home Camp Google group. Well, Home Camp is a kind of informal community.
All right, okay.
Built around, there's been two kind of bar camp events now in London, I think, all around home automation and
power saving,
energy monitoring, anything. It's sort of a combination of green and technology. And they've got a Google group, so I was curious about whether it was possible to sort of replace our heating controller, which is a wireless digital heating controller, with a PC and an Arduino that would just send on and off commands, quite simple, and it wouldn't involve taking the boiler apart or anything. So I asked the question on the Google group, and it started about, that thread went well, and then another couple of threads after that.
It was a good thread. It was really interesting. Geeky as well.
Yeah.
Really geeky.
So I was very proud of that because I didn't provide most of the information. But yeah, because then Mike the Bee then does a summary of what's been happening in the past couple of weeks or so on his podcast and then mentioned my name.
Excellent. We'll put a link to the podcast in the show notes.
And I got a pimp on my blog. And
cool. Baby, tell us about your Mac.
Well, you may recall that I bought a Mac laptop and, an Apple laptop, and I tried to put Ubuntu on it. And the standard Lucid installer won't see the hard drive. There's a problem with the SATA controller. So Dave, who is a star and is currently out in Prague with Canonical on a sprint.
Yep. He's into running.
I don't think he is. Uh-huh. Not that kind of sprint. He also has exactly the same laptop and has the same problem. And he worked on making an ISO image which had the right drivers on it. And I tested it and a few other people tested it. And it's now in a Lucid update, so you can now install Ubuntu on this particular model of Mac laptop.
Excellent.
And it works okay. There are some quirks with it still, like the mouse and the keyboard lights and various bits and bobs, but it's good. It's been a bit frustrating being stuck in OS X, but
you bought the hardware.
Yeah, I did, and I bought it, as I've mentioned previously, under instruction from somebody who works from Canonical, saying it will be all right, everything will work. Lies.
Is that what you're running at the moment?
Is what I'm running at the moment?
Ubuntu.
No. Well, right now while you're looking at me.
Well, right now.
Yeah. No, because the mouse is a bit twitchy on Ubuntu, and there's some special modules you need to download and compile and stuff at the moment.
Sounds
it's a bit
like
bleeding
a lot of
edge.
Hard work.
You need to replace it with
It's not actually that much. We've got a group who document each of the quirks with the Mac. because there's stuff that the Mac has that other people don't have, like variable illuminating light, keyboard light and other bits and bobs.
Hey, I bought an HP laptop. Do you know what? It just works.
Yeah, that's nice
for you.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's ugly though.
Negative.
It's not. It's really not ugly, that one.
So
it's sweet.
Have you done anything with computer in the last fortnight at all, Simon?
No.
You've had your Android phone attached to you.
I have had my Android phone, but I've been out of the country and I've actually been cold turkey.
Cool.
No internet connectivity.
Wow.
Sweaty palms?
No. It was quite good, actually. About the third day, and I got a bit sort of, oh, I need to check my email. But I thought, no, I'm not good. Just left it, and it was fine.
It's good to unplug every so often, isn't it?
Yeah, the interesting thing, when I got to the airport, I couldn't stand it anymore. And I logged onto my email. I had 300 emails. Okay, let's see how long this takes. And out of all the emails, I think 3 were directed to me and took about 5 minutes to clear. The rest were email lists. Nothing direct, just, you know, delete.
Doesn't that make you feel popular?
No, it doesn't, not at all, because it's all just, you know, list stuff. And if it's really important, they'll get back to me. So it's the easy way to deal with all those emails. And the news feed as well, like 2,000 articles to read in there, right. Just highlight the lot, delete, gone, not going to read them.
Inbox 0.
Yeah, inbox 0. It took about 10 minutes.
Well, we're going to do a segment at some point about managing your email. That's the way. Sounds like you've just done it.
There we go. Dub done.
If you've got loads, delete it all.
Yeah.
Well, seriously.
Cool. Right. Well, let's get on with the show.
We're delighted to have on the phone Joe Shields, otherwise known as DirectX on IRC. Hello, Joe. How are you?
I'm all right. Getting by. How are you guys?
Yeah, tickety-boo.
Not too bad. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. So, probably... some people won't know who you are. I can't imagine who these people
are.
But do you want to give us a brief intro to, you know, what you do for Ubuntu and Debian?
Right, okay. I'm a Motu, what have you supposed to pronounce that, and a Debian developer. I've sort of been contributing since around 2008, I think, is when I started officially contributing to Ubuntu. And I am kind of one of the senior people who helps work on Mono and Mono-related stuff. And,
so is that,
and all of that
packaging?
Evil. Packaging, mostly, yeah.
Bug fixing,
that kind of thing.
Right.
Do you do the same things for Debian as you do with Ubuntu? Is it Mono-based work?
Yes.
Okay. And what attracted you to work on Mono?
I was doing a project at work, and I need to write some software. And I, because I'm a systems manager for my day job, and I have to write some software to do something, I did the obvious thing and wrote it in Perl.
Right.
And then I quickly discovered that writing a large GUI application in Perl becomes very unmaintainable very quickly. So I started hunting around for other ways to write software for Linux, because this was sort of a Linux-only project, and I wanted to write a GUI app. And I tried a few things here and there. I had a look at what was current, and this is going back 2007, I think.
Okay.
And of all the things I tried, the best by a huge margin, even though it wasn't 100%, was Bono Develop and C#.
Best in what way?
I found it relatively intuitive to work with. I thought the GUI editing stuff was pleasant, and it seemed relatively easy to get working. Just the whole workflow thing appealed to me as a programmer, so I started using it. And then it started becoming the case that the packages in Ubuntu for the Mono development stuff weren't getting as much attention from their maintainer as I thought they needed. The guy who was previously the Ubuntu Mono maintainer got busy with other projects, so I sort of stepped up to help there.
And so you started work on Mono in Mono packages in Ubuntu first, and then filtered up to Debian, is that right?
Yeah, well, before even that, I was working on an unofficial third-party repository where I was sort of keeping my own updates because they weren't happening in Ubuntu. And then I thought, you know, this would be a lot easier if I just did it in Ubuntu.
Right.
And then I started doing it in Ubuntu and thought, you know, this would be a lot easier if I just did it in Debian.
Sorry, so you started off as an Ubuntu developer and then became a Debian developer? Is that the way around?
That's the way around.
Was it difficult going from one discipline to another?
Honestly, not really. I mean, there are. It's a lot harder to become a Debian developer. It's really quite a. They quiz you on technical skills and things in a way that they don't for Ubuntu.
Do you have to sit in a on Ubuntu? You have the developer membership board meeting on IRC that you sit in, and you know they quiz you about various things. I think to be a Motu, isn't that the case?
You basically get an exam. That's the only way to phrase it. Is about 30 questions.
Wow.
And these are involved things like talking about version symboling in C and all of that.
Pretty
involved stuff in there.
Tony does that in his sleep, apparently.
Does Tony know what C
is? I had to do a fair bit of research for some of those because I wasn't really interested in some of the things that the questions were written around, because I assumed that I'd know about Emacs modules and that kind of thing.
Blimey. Oh, my God.
It's quite hardcore, isn't it?
It's pretty hardcore, but the main focus of doing this was that anyone can contribute to Debian. You don't have to be a Debian developer or a Debian maintainer to contribute to Debian. But you can only upload a package if you're a Debian developer. So I spent a while contributing to Debian as a way to get stuff into Ubuntu. But we had one Debian developer who was actively working on Mono stuff. So if he went on holiday, then nobody else would be able to upload any Mono-related stuff. So I became a Debian developer basically to help him even out the workload, as it were, from contributors. And we've got a few people contributing to Mono on Ubuntu and Debian.
So now that you're on both sides of the fence, as it were, do you package for Debian first? Is that your first target now?
Yep,
and then that filters down?
That's always my first target. And it's very uncommon that there are situations where it's not possible to go to Debian first. And even when it's not, even if you've got to make changes for Ubuntu, you should be able to put 99% of it into Debian and then just have a couple of lines difference in Ubuntu.
I was quite surprised that you said that Ubuntu had fallen behind in the version of Mono and things that it was running, because Mono is quite essential to some core Ubuntu apps like FSpot.
It is.
Was that not a problem?
If stuff just keeps working, then you tend not to pay attention to it.
Right.
So as long as it wasn't crashing horribly, people were just fine with whatever they were getting. And what ended up happening is people who didn't really know about Mono were doing the updates to packages. So they were taking the Debian version and making their best efforts to do an update without necessarily understanding why certain things were done the way they were.
Right.
And we only have a couple of core applications on the CD, but a few extra things in the repository. And there's a few other apps that are written in or use the Mono libraries, like iFolder, that, you know, is quite a decent, apparently a decent app, but doesn't seem to be packaged. Is that something you're looking to work on?
iFolder, I've looked at it and I've tried to do some work on it. The short answer is it's probably the biggest challenge I've ever faced in packaging.
Wow.
And I've packaged some monsters.
And what is it? It's nothing to do with it actually being a Mono app. It's more, what is the blocker there?
You're right. It's not so much that it's a Mono app. It's just the way it's been written. For example, there's a lot of hard coding in a lot of places.
Hard coding for Novell stuff? Or the SUSE way?
Yeah.
Right.
Or for configuration. Everything's supposed to be configured through SUSE-ish apps that write config files in SUSE-ish ways. And it's trying to decouple that, trying to make it so that, for example, you can compile the desktop client and the server out of the same source package, which is actually remarkably difficult to do with the way that iFolder has been written.
Right.
And things like that. So I kind of made a preliminary hack. And there's a Google Groups group who had a go with it. But I had some other stuff on that I had to take care of, and I haven't gone back to it, because every time I think of going back and finishing it, I just think, oh, God, I don't want to work on this.
And it seems that a few people have attacked that particular package, and none have come out victorious. But that package aside, does the negative press that Mono gets mean that people are less likely to get involved in it, do you think?
I think probably. I think it would be naive not to. I'm not going to name any names because I don't know if it was said in confidence, but at UDS in Barcelona, I forget which year that was, I spoke to a developer who said he would much rather be writing the app in C#, but he wrote it in Python, because if he wrote it in C#, he wouldn't get any contributors.
Wow. Which is sad, because it's free software, isn't it?
It is free software,
and this is one of the troubles with the whole Mono debacle. There are, you know, some vehemently anti-mono people in the world. And obviously you come, being that you're someone who is deeply involved in mono, you come across these people, don't you?
You could say that, yeah.
So what's it like? Are you on the receiving end of some of their anger and their vigour? Do you take it personally, or do you manage to let it sort of go over your head?
I used to. Honest answer, I got really worked up over it for a while. I would find it really depressing to be attacked constantly. And then I just started ignoring it, which is very easy to do when you start adding entries to etc. hosts to block certain web pages. And since then, just ignoring it helps. I mean, when all said and done, it's like getting concerned and going, those Tea Party people in the US won't believe the president is really an American. That's not fair, wah. You know, you may as well just write off the people you think are crazy as crazies.
Right.
There's no point trying to convince people who are that certain about what they think.
And one of the... I remember a recent blog post related to this. You had a bit of a rant about the fact that one of the UK TV networks has switched away from the Silverlight-based content delivery system they use. What was the big problem with that? I mean, there don't seem to be that many websites that use Silverlight or in any way.
There aren't that many websites using Silverlight because Flash has got the market dominance, which is the same argument people use for saying, well, Windows has got market dominance.
So let's not use Ubuntu, yeah.
Here's the thing. If you want to watch TV online with the Adobe plugin, then you're fine. You can watch your Channel 4, your ITV, they work. But let's face it, the Adobe plugin is awful. It's really, really bad. And I've been using 64-bit Linux for about 7 years now, I think. So I know just how awful it can be trying to do Flash online. And if you want to use a free software plugin, because free software always has the potential to be better, you can't watch any of those. None of the UK networks work with free software plugins. But one of them used to. ITV used to work with free software because they were using Silverlight and not Flash.
But it required some bleeding edge version of...
It did need a bleeding edge version. I had some spirited debates with the Moonlight Upstream people, asking them to make a new release with just the right version, so I could package it up, which I unfortunately didn't get. So I had it working. I demonstrated it working. I had screenshots of it working, although I took screenshots just as the screen was going black for a transition. Didn't help.
Dope.
And given I was demonstrating it in my usual sarcastic manner with a chinchilla in view, it's really hard to get those things to stand still. So I had two chances with two chinchillas, and I just used the least black of the two screenshots.
Yes.
But it worked. It was the short version. It worked, and since they moved to Flash, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I tried with what I thought was an update version of Nash. I haven't been told it works with anything newer.
It is so frustrating that we have to rely on, you know, these third-party plugins that are non-free. But it seems everyone has to, you know, unless you happen to be Apple and you control the platform and you don't allow Flash.
Well, that's a different argument. Apple are just being deceitful with that. But, yeah, it's frustrating because it did work. It was an example where you could say, look, free software does everything. You know, if you had a spouse who spends a lot of time watching shows on ITV, like, I don't know, the Jeremy Kyle show. And I know that
one
because the other show she likes watching, I probably shouldn't mention on the air.
Okay.
You know, her netbook runs Ubuntu, and she could watch everything she wanted, do everything she wanted, top to bottom with free software, until ITV moved on to Flash. And then she couldn't. Then she had to start using the Adobe plugin. So I found that frustrating, and what I found especially frustrating was that it was hailed as a victory by the so-called free software advocates.
Right. Because it was not mono.
Because it was not mono.
Not because it was Flash.
And similarly, another one that I thought was a better example, in the US, Major League Baseball did their high definition streaming with Silverlight, and then they dropped that, which was seen as a victory by the free software people.
Mm.
But what they dropped it for was Flash with an extra Windows only add-in to make it use Windows Media Video.
Right. Nice. So this must be obviously frustrating, but equally, looking at it from a user's perspective, if there isn't an easy, viable way to get the Silverlight-compatible free software stuff to make that work, then they're going to see, oh, it's gone to Flash. Great, that's a success, aren't they? Because I can probably now watch it, you know.
Very probably, but call me a purist, if you like.
You're a purist.
Thank you.
I was asking for trouble.
It was. So one of the other things...
We talked about this in the last episode. We talked about your Grub splash screen that you've developed. Tell us a little bit about why you did that.
Okay, apparently Grub has supported graphical splash screens since 2008.
Really?
But nobody's ever made one.
Wow.
Oh.
That seems implausible.
Yeah, I know. But,
I believe you, but...
basically, someone did support for it as a Google Summer of Code project.
Oh. Right.
And it got committed, but then no one ever fixed up the example themes to work with the committed version of the graphics menu support.
Right.
So is it a significant amount of work to do to create a theme? Sorry. Is it a significant amount of work to create a theme?
Not really. I mean, there were some bugs. I basically, because I was the first one using this code in anger, I've reported a few bugs, and they tend to get fixed very quickly by... The guy who's currently maintaining that code is a great guy called himself PH Coder. And basically, every time I make a release, I tend to say it needs this exact bizarre revision, because that's the version that's got all the fixes that I asked for.
So is this something that you think we'll see in Maverick or a future Ubuntu release?
Honestly, I doubt it, because it delays booting by about half a second to a second.
Oh, we can't have that.
And we can't have that. But I expect it, I would hope that the Grub packager, Colin Watson, I think, is still packaging it. I would hope that he would package it up such that you could have it if you wanted it.
That would be quite cool, because it is quite pretty.
It's certainly prettier than the default Grub menu.
Yes.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. If you're going to have a nice, pretty distro, there's no reason to have a crummy-looking...
It looks like you step back to the era of teletypes
when
you boot your machine.
And the only people who see that are the people who are dual-booting.
Yeah,
which is a lot of people.
It hides it, and it only shows if there's multiple OSs to show. It would be nice if those people got a nice experience, or I think so anyway.
And does it segue nicely into the boot splash? Is it a seamless transition, or is there a bit of flickering? And
it's not seamless in any environment I've tested it, but I haven't really tried any of the frame buffer fiddling in anger.
Right, okay.
I think that's a problem for all of the boot up things. I've not seen any. Sure. I mean, some of them are claiming to be, you know, pretty clean and less flickering, but I don't know any machine I own that doesn't at some point show me a black screen with a flashing cursor.
Yeah, exactly. It would be cool to not have that at any point.
Yeah.
After the piles.
It would be cool, but it's not something I worry about. I let the Grub guys worry about that.
Fair enough.
And the X guys.
And the X guys and the Kernel guys now as well.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Cool.
There was one question, but going back to Ubuntu and being an Ubuntu and Debian developer, and do you ever find there's a conflict of interest between putting things in one and the other? Because I think a lot of people don't really appreciate what the process is for each of the two distributions.
Honestly, I don't think so. I think what people ignore is that most of what's in Ubuntu is copied byte for byte from Debian. I mean, there's about, I think, 18,000 source packages, something along those lines, which is a big number. And there's about 1,000 Debian developers, and there's rather less Ubuntu contributors.
Yeah.
So just in terms of the amount of work to do, it makes sense to sort of minimize the duplication of effort. So every time I can, I will try and put something into Debian first. And there are a couple of examples where I can't. So an example there is Moonlight. I can't update the package in Debian because I have a disagreement with the security team over the little issue of Moonlight needing an entire copy of the mono source code in order to compile, and they don't like having copies of source code lying around.
What, so, on our post-install or in the repo?
Just to compile the package in the repo.
Surely everything needs the source code in the repo to compile.
Well, Moonlight needs its own copy of the mono source. It doesn't just use the system's mono source. It needs its own local, slightly forked copy.
Ugh. Sounds vaguely FFmpeg-like.
Icky.
Yeah.
Mm. I think Chromium does the same thing, except it bundles about 18 different major libraries.
Yeah.
And it's icky, it's horrible, I agree. But the reality of the situation is, if you want the software, then sometimes you have to put up with stupidities from upstream.
Yeah.
So that's when I put directly into Ubuntu. And as it happens, I actually forgot to upload an updated package to that. So I can do that right now, live on air. As you are listening to this podcast, I'm uploading a Moonlight package.
Well, whilst you're uploading, I did some packaging a little while ago, some bug work, and I went through the frustration of understanding that once you've done the work on Ubuntu, you've then got to go and do it on Debian, which appears to be where you've come from. So are you almost at the point where you're not doing any work on Ubuntu, you're doing all of it on Debian because you know it's going to filter downstream eventually?
About 95%. Yeah. But the way I see it, the only times I need to upload to Ubuntu when there's a really big blocker on me uploading to Debian. Okay. And even things like, say, after feature freeze in Ubuntu, I will still upload it to Debian and then sync across to Ubuntu.
Do you know what kind of proportion of Ubuntu developers do both Debian and Ubuntu work?
Honestly, I have no idea. Someone was looking at this. I think they gave a talk at UDS. I'm trying to remember who it was, though.
Yes, they did.
Was it Lucas?
Yes.
Nussbaum or Nussbaum
or whatever. Yes.
I don't want to embarrass myself by pronouncing it, but there you go.
Leave that to us.
Yeah, we'll do that. Lucas Nussbaum was.
Yeah,
please edit that out.
No.
No, I have no idea what percentage go where. I know that there is a perception that Debian doesn't welcome random contributors. And for some packages, that's true. And I think that's just the perception people have now, is if you contribute to Debian, you'll get people shouting at you for not being pure enough or whatever.
And not reading the documentation fully and making your Debian control files absolutely letter perfect.
Yeah. And I think for some packages, that's true. Some of them are considered a bit weird, even by Debian standards. and I'm especially not naming names there.
Well, we had the Debian project lead come to the Ubuntu Developer Summit and talk about the relationship between Debian and Ubuntu, and he seems to think it's going fairly well.
I think, well, certainly within the bits I work on, it is as well. To give a bit more background for that, which is sort of heading back in time a bit, when I wanted to start contributing more formally to Mono in Debian, it was around the time that they were looking at doing a major transition on the way that some packaging is done, which would reduce the amount of space it takes to install stuff like FSpot and Tomboy.
Uh-huh.
And it was a fairly major piece of work. It needed patching about 90 packages. And I thought, well, that's a lot of work for like one or two guys, but how about if I get as many Ubuntu contributors as I can find to help, and we can get it done in like a couple of months instead of the 6, 7, 8 months he was estimating.
Right.
And we did.
Oh.
We got the whole transition done in time for a release, and the main Debian Mono guy was just ecstatic with how helpful everyone was, with the amount of contribution he got.
And these were just general Ubuntu developers, no one who has a specific interest in Mono or the specific packages.
I mean, some of them have stuck around now to help on Mono stuff. But
that's rather cool.
Yeah. And it basically completely changed his perception of Ubuntu and the whole Debian-Ubuntu relationship for the better. So now he has a PPA for one of his packages where he uploads things like that because he cares about the Ubuntu users, and he moans at me for not putting enough Ubuntu changes back into Debian.
Right. Good. As it should be. Well, listen, it's been fantastic talking to you, and thank you for letting us know all about the work you do for Debian and Ubuntu.
Yeah, we better leave you to get on with uploading those packages.
And stroking your chinchilla in a weird overlord way.
Which is not a dog, apparently. Seems,
so yes. There we go, contributing to the evil of mono infection.
Excellent.
People tell me, and I even name-checked the podcast in there. So,
fantastic.
Check the Debian changelog file once that hits Maverick.
Wow.
Lovely.
Excellent.
Fame at last. I think we've been in the man page, haven't we, before? Yeah. So now we're going to be in a commit log as well.
Yeah, excellent. Fantastic.
Anyway, thank you for talking to us this evening, Joe.
No problem.
Take care.
Cheers, Joe. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
See ya. And it's time for the news.
The popular music streaming application Spotify is coming to Linux. A preview release of a native Linux client appeared last week. Previously, we'd had to resort to running the Windows version under Wine, which apparently worked quite well.
It did. Yep.
Are you a Spotify user?
I have an account, and I installed it and went, yeah, that works.
Now, Spotify works, are you sort of a pay a monthly subscription or something like that, and you can access music?
I think it has different models. It's got multiple different...
What's the difference between that and Last.fm? Because I've never used Spotify.
Last.fm is completely free, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although you can pay for a pro account, I guess, with Last.fm, I think. But I don't.
Well, it's good to see proper applications. Proper applications. You know what I mean. Popular Windows applications coming to Linux. And Mac applications.
Except iTunes.
Name one. Popular Mac applications come to Linux.
Spotify.
Okay.
Yeah, gotcha.
Google Labs have released App Inventor, a visual development environment for Android applications. They claim that no programming experience is necessary to create even complex applications, like one using the GPS facility.
Hmm.
Really?
Yeah, it's got like a drag and droppy, like you pull in a piece that is like a loop, and you pull in a piece that calls something, and you can construct a program just by pulling in building blocks.
It's a bit like a flowchart. You sort of construct a flowchart if X or Y do A and B or whatever.
Yeah, but without actually having to know any of the nitty-gritty of the programming language underneath. It generates the code for you.
Wow.
Some would argue that it generates rubbish code, because all code generators generate rubbish code, but it's a good in, like, if someone's like, you know, children want to learn and some adults want to learn programming.
Yeah, get a proof of concept of your application, and then maybe if it's successful enough initially, you could get it written properly. If you know what I mean.
Well, it's kind of aimed optimized at educators. When you, you can't actually download it, you have to request an invite or request a download, and it asks you like basic questions. And then one of them is about what, you know, what do you do, and why should we give you an invite to this? Right. And it kind of implies that they would probably prefer you to be an educator of some sort, teacher or trainer or something.
Fair enough.
Linux Mint have started to move away from being based on Ubuntu to being based on Debian testing. This seems to be to allow rolling releases, and there's clearly no sentimentality towards Ubuntu from the Linux Mint team. We've never considered our goal to be linked to Ubuntu in any way. We consider Ubuntu one of the upstream components that we'll use on some of the systems we distribute, the way we distribute GNOME.
Is that a quote from their announcement?
Yes. Yes.
So this isn't, they're not the only people to be moving away from Ubuntu.
Yeah. Who else did?
Crunchbang.
Crunchbang, yes. Mm. Oh, yeah, of course. Phil Newbra. Mm. And we even interviewed him.
So what's the attraction, do you reckon, of Debian testing over Ubuntu?
I don't think it's the attraction as the repulsion
That's a negative
Ubuntu
way of putting it.
Well, that's the way they've put it, really.
Yeah.
I think they don't like the commercial side of things, like the tight integration of things like Ubuntu One and Landscape and that kind of stuff.
But they don't have to ship that.
No, but it does quite tightly integrate to Ubuntu now. So, you know, some of the... I don't know how easy it is to pull that out.
Unpick it.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, for example, now, Maverick has even more close integration with Ubuntu One, which maybe we'll talk about when we come to talk about Maverick at some point.
Yeah. Well, maybe that Ubuntu is less suitable now as a platform for other derivatives than it once was. But the idea of moving to testing so you can have a rolling release program is quite a change in the way that they are obviously running their distribution as well. Because you're not doing set releases every 6 months. So you're rolling.
I think it was quite painful for them doing a release, like having to redo everything after each Ubuntu release.
Yeah.
That must be pretty painful, whereas the rolling might make it easier, especially testing where you've got things that have had some element of testing in unstable.
Yeah.
So comparing this to the Apple Store versus Android debate we just had, are we going to get a better product out of Debian or a better product out of Ubuntu? Because
we theory, being well,
the users,
Mint.
The users, are the users
of
going
what,
to get
Linux Mint?
Yeah.
Right.
Are they going to get a better product out of Debian or a better product out of Ubuntu? Bearing in mind, a lot of the developers for Ubuntu are well paid, and you know,
how do you measure better? Is better more free, less commercial interest, or is better more stable, or is better rolling releases, or is better I want my release to be more stable and I only want it changed every 6 months,
or more sustainable?
Hmm.
I think I could see how moving
or more brown
to Debian or
purple.
Sorry, purple.
Aubergine. I think I could see how moving to Debian testing might be more might save some effort for the Linux Mint team on a technical basis. I could see that, but
there's the philosophical thing as well that Debian's always made out to be. It always makes itself out to be the kind of won't stand for anything that's non-free and things, whereas Ubuntu is pragmatic.
Whereas Ubuntu does. Yeah. Well, you say that, but I almost thought that Linux Mint, a version of Linux Mint, shipped with all kinds of extra stuff, codecs and Flash. Did it not? At some point in the past. So I'm not sure that that's an argument that they would necessarily use.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, it did.
Which was one of the reasons why it was touted as being good for users.
Yeah.
Is because you didn't have to worry about codecs and Flash and fonts and all that kind of stuff, because it was all just there. So I'm not sure that would be a motivating factor for them. I think probably, I mean, for some it will be, obviously.
IBM have announced that Mozilla Firefox will be their default browser, citing Firefox's extensibility and standards compliance as major motivators. That's 400,000 employees who will now be asked to use Firefox instead of Internet Explorer.
Asked, as in they can turn it down.
As in they can choose to use something else.
IE's already on your Windows machine, isn't it?
It's probably pretty hard to rip it out, really.
Yeah.
Presumably this means that IBM have made all their internal systems work with Firefox and be compatible.
You'd hope so.
You'd hope so.
It's going to really annoy the employees if they can't do their expenses because it doesn't work in Firefox.
The blog post was from Bob Suter, who is a vice president of open source and Linux for IBM. And he says that there's going to be support and things for people who want help moving to a different browser if they need it.
It's funny because I look around at work, the office that I work in, which is, you know, a fairly decent-sized company and full of non-technical people. There's a fair number of them who've already made the switch, whether it's sanctioned by their local IT or not. They've already chosen to switch to Firefox or Chrome. A lot of people are using Chrome.
Ironically, I see the opposite in that there are people that are incredibly techy, developing all day, every day, and they still run IE. And that always kind of surprises me.
Yeah, I see a few of those.
And but they don't even have Firefox installed even.
But then some people, technical people, make some wacky decisions. I work with people who SSH to a box and then start a VNC server on a server and then VNC in and then start
and then
10
run
Xterms. Yeah, I've tried to get them to use GNU screen and shown them the joy of split screen and being able to have multiple windows open in screen and then disconnect from the SSH session and walk to another machine and SSH in and go, look, it's all still there. And they're like, yeah, but VNC works. Well, okay, lost cause.
That's a massive topic of discussion. We should get into some time about these people.
Yeah. these people.
Yeah, these people.
Techies who aren't really.
Those people over there who need a real good slapping.
That's everyone other than us.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all wrong.
Splitters, all of them. Especially those people that won't use Biobi. But that's another discussion.
Only a couple of events on the schedule today.
OIGCon is on the 24th of July in London.
That's this Saturday.
Yeah, I'm going. Still
going. You can still sit behind Alan in a
tied up, literally.
Oh,
no, you're not going.
Ah, that's different.
No.
Software Freedom Day is on the 18th of September all around the world.
Excellent. Is there stuff happening in the UK?
Actually, it's funny you should say that.
That sounded very
slightly prepared.
Yeah.
Just half an hour ago, Les Pounder sent a mail to say he's going to be doing an Ubuntu install fest on Software Freedom Day, 18th of September, in the Manchester area.
Brilliant. Now, Les ran the Ubuntu install desk at Odcamp.
Yes, that's right.
10. So
and at Barcamp Blackpool.
That? So he's very good at that.
And he's going to take along his juggler.
It's a nice northern event.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. Yeah.
I was just about to say.
And if anyone else wants to run one in the Outer Hebrides or the Isle of Man or Penzance Wales. Or Wales or wherever, then we'll put a link to the post.
Northern Ireland,
Millbank Towns.
Anywhere.
Wolverhampton.
No.
And finally, don't forget the Geeknik in London on Sunday, the 8th of August.
Whereabouts in London?
We'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay.
There's a big list where you can put your name down and say that you're coming.
So it's a picnic in a park with geeks.
And significant others and other people as well.
Okay, cool.
So it's designed to be a family event.
Sounds like fun. Let's hope it doesn't rain.
I think they're going to have alternative plans for if it rains.
An umbrella.
Bus shelter.
In your car.
Well then, Alan, how did the Ubuntu in Business event go last week?
Yeah, that wasn't contrived
at all. No, that wasn't a setup. Now, how did it go? Because I was seeing various tweets from the event on the day itself. It looked like Alan Bell was very, very tall up in the roof.
Yeah, it was a strange venue. It was in Brick Lane in London, and it was called Ubuntu in Business.
Oh, Brick Lane. Good curries then.
I don't know. We didn't go out for curry.
Oh, really?
No, we had the food was laid on in the venue.
Oh, right, okay.
Which was amazing. So the venue was it was a bar entertainment spot place, and it's a bit quirky. It's split on three levels. It's quite narrow and long, and it's got a bar at the end and a stage partway along. And the intention was to try and get people, geeks, who evangelize and advocate the use of Ubuntu and free software to bring along someone else, and we talk to that someone else and show that other person, who maybe is a disbeliever, or, you know...
Not yet converted.
Yeah, perhaps. not yet part of our gang, and let them know how we use Ubuntu in business and how Ubuntu is effective in business.
So was it very busy?
It was about 200 people registered on Eventbrite for the event.
Okay.
And we anticipated about a 50% drop-off.
Right.
Of people just not turning up or dropping us an email and saying, I can't come.
Right.
And that was pretty much what we got. 100 people turned up.
Fair enough.
So we got pretty much exactly the number that we expected. We did get a fair number of techies, of geeks, which is kind of not the audience we wanted. We did get some people, some fairly important people, you know, high up in the London Stock Exchange and a few other, you know, cool people. And I spoke to Jerry Carr from Canonical Marketing about it, and he was happy with how it went as a first run and thinks that we should do more of these kind of events. He was more interested in doing more of these Ubuntu in business events.
Yes.
Maybe around the country, maybe different types of venues, targeting different types of people. But I think, as well as that, that's from the Canonical side. And it was a joint Canonical and community event. We helped promote it. It was actually a community idea. The whole thing was thought up by Alan Bell and Alan Lord at the Open Learning Center.
Yeah.
So it was a community-driven event, but, you know, organized together with Canonical, and they sponsored the drinks, and we had Ubuntinis.
Lovely.
Which are an acquired taste. If you get a chance to have one, just have one.
Is it true that they're made from Mark Shuttleworth socks that have been strained?
Mark Shuttleworth aubergine socks.
Socks.
No, they're not.
Okay.
You'd be forgiven for thinking that. they're an acquired taste. Anyway, one thing that I wanted to talk about is events where it's not a technical bent, like, you know, lugs. And I blogged about this today and posted on the UK mailing list about how we go to the people and how we get those people interested in Ubuntu. And I was interested in hearing ideas about where we could go that people are, you know, and introduce them to Ubuntu.
Because it's one of the things that I think Dan Lynch from Linux Outlaws mentioned at OCCAMP was that in some senses we're always kind of preaching to the converted at events like OCCAMP. You know, we sort of reinforce each other's views. We don't really go out and spread the word, if you like, in the wider community.
Of course, that depends on if your motivation is to get other people interested in Ubuntu. If we take that as read, that we want other people to use Ubuntu and we want to show them how good it is. So if you take that as read, where do we go?
Yeah. Well, Laura and I were at our Village Fete.
Oh, yes.
On Saturday, weren't we?
Yes.
And it wandering around the little stalls there and stuff, there were falconry and the Women's Institute and the churches.
Very community focused,
Scouts.
Wasn't it?
It really was very community focused, yeah. And the local photography club and things were there as well. And I said to her as I was walking around, partly jokingly, but maybe partly seriously, sort of saying, well, the podcast should have had a stand here. You know, we are almost
probably
certainly the biggest podcast produced in the village. certainly in terms of the number of downloads and stuff that we get. And it would be great for people in the wider community to sort of know that this was going on in the local area. And it could be a bit of an advocacy thing, having maybe Ubuntu there and available. Also, we could, you know, maybe try and interview people. We may even have people come up to us and say, oh, yeah, I've tried that. And we could, you know, get some content for the show and things as well.
Yeah, one of the things we've done in the past is at Software Freedom Day, we've gone out there to the public and
stood outside Morrison's and things like that.
Well, on one occasion, we walked through London and with the Greater London Linux User Group, and we had a whole bunch of CDs from Canonical, and we printed out some leaflets, and we were handing them out in the street. Mm. And it's a bit of a scattergun approach. You know, you're just randomly giving CDs to people. They're not coming to you. They're not necessarily interested in what you've got to say. You're kind of, you know, in the same way as a guy stands at the corner and with a golf sale sign handing out leaflets, or the guy on the corner giving out, you know, discounts for McDonald's or whatever.
Yeah.
You're not going to them. You're not. Whereas with a stand at something like a Fete, you're standing there, you put your stand out, and people can
come to you.
Come to you if they want to.
So what do you use as the killer points to get people to come to your stand? You've got something to attract them. I mean, what?
A juggler playing a looped video.
Yeah.
It's a bit small to be seen from the other side of an event, I guess.
But you've got something that says, you know, you must come here, you must try this.
I think a Village Fete with a 42-inch plasma screen behind the stand.
Quite a few of those stands had sweeties on them.
Yeah.
That seemed to work quite well.
That gets the kids in. Yeah. Okay.
Get me in.
Well, me too, to be fair. A handful of those in my pocket.
You have to project the right image as well, haven't you? You can't just be, you know, stood there in your tatty jeans and all that sort of stuff. You've got to be...
Why not?
Because
real people wear tatty jeans.
No, because it gives the wrong image.
Does it?
Yeah, it does. Because you will be stood there giving away free software. And most people think free software is pirated and it's all ripped off films and all that sort of stuff.
You can talk to them while you do. You don't have to necessarily give them a CD and go, here you go, mate, have this.
Yeah, but you have to actually get them to that point.
What, of talking to you?
Yeah.
Well, the fact they've walked up is a good start.
Yeah,
but even before then, they're going to take a look over at you.
Look at that, dodgy films over there. Look at that. Can you believe those people? Scruffy people giving away stolen films.
Would you get proper ones from Canonical?
Plus, you know, that Ubuntu brand, you know, it's surprisingly... You know, well known, well seen. You know, people.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really?
I've told you numerous times about the guy in the corner shop who looked at my T-shirt with a Hardy Heron on it and went, "Where have I seen that before?" And I said, "Your desktop." And he went, "Oh yeah."
I wear my Ubuntu T-shirts around occasionally and get spotted. Mm. I think I got spotted in Nice.
Yeah.
What?
Hotel in Nice.
Somebody was looking at my T-shirt going, "Well, I recognise that."
And in the local co-op.
And in the local co-op, rather less exotically.
They're all co-op employees run Ubuntu. They must do.
But their tills certainly don't, as I saw when one crashed.
very much Windows.
But there are these sort of, you know, wider community events where... we tried doing InfoPoint stands at computer fairs, and they were reasonably successful, and that was a perhaps more geeky market. But, you know, one of the things about Ubuntu is for human beings, not just kind of geeks or a subset of people who are interested in computers and computing.
People at those computer fairs tend to be self-selecting.
You
wouldn't spend a Sunday afternoon in a computer fair unless you're interested in buying a hard drive enclosure or a USB key or, new screen or something. And Alan Cox, who every month in Bracknell runs an InfoPoint stand at a computer fair, I went along a couple of times and dropped off some CDs from Canonical to him. And people wander by and, you know, people see him every month and come over and say hello. And sometimes there are people who go past a couple of times and then on the third occasion they'll, like, take a CD or something. But also you get, like, there are little kids walking by and they go, yeah, I use that, and, like, wander off. So, yeah, you are kind of, you know, you're not capturing many new people there.
No, but I think Alan does a great job, and he's certainly got a lot of stamina. But as you say, a very self-selecting group, perhaps. But it would be great to see people perhaps doing those sort of advocacy stands at, you know, school fetes or whatever. It's the season for it. Or church fairs or whatever might be going on in your community at the time.
Or classes, if you go to a class of some kind, like yoga or French or something. I don't know. Evening classes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Different set of people.
One of the things that Dan Lynch mentioned again was that he went to a bar camp, and I can't remember which bar camp it was, but even there he found out that a lot of people weren't familiar with Linux and open source.
They're web developer types. Or
they're hardware tinkerers and they're soldering stuff and whatever, but they just weren't really into the open source thing. So even at a reasonably techie audience, there was a lot of people there to be talked about too, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and I mean, he actually did an introduction to open source software, I think it was.
Mm. Oh, he did a lightning talk, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that was who he was pitching to, so that's quite, even though they were geeks. Mm.
One of the things that triggered off this blog post was Amber Grainer, who edits the Ubuntu Weekly News, went to a goat farm day thing,
right?
A goat festival. And at the goat festival, you know, her son was wearing his Ubuntu t-shirt and she was wearing hers, and they were dishing out Ubuntu CDs. She's got a great photo of her with a goat.
Nice.
Holding a CD just before the goat munches the cardboard, I'm sure.
Satanic edition, was it?
No. No. No, they like goats.
Oh, right, okay.
They're not sacrificing them.
Right, fair enough.
And it was that kind of event. It's like, you know, there are people there who use computers as a tool. And these are people who, you know, may not appreciate that there are options out there. Yeah, when you go to a techie conference, people read magazines and they see mention of Linux and stuff, and then they think
this comes back to what I started off with. You've got to have a killer point to say to somebody, look, and you haven't got that operating system on your PC, take this away and whatever it is, you'll have no more viruses, there you go. Or it's all free. You don't have to pay for anything. You've got to have something to get them to have a go.
I don't think you have to try that hard. I really don't. Because when you've got a bunch of free things, especially CDs, computer software, and it's proper free, you know, and it's not dodgy, and, you know, you've got leaflets and you can have banners up and all that kind of stuff to attract people. Yep. And once you get them over, if you're a personable person and not, like you say, a, you know, hairy, sweaty, farty geek who's you know, unapproachable. If you're the kind of person, and someone who's personable, like, that's one of the reasons why Alan Cox is so successful in Bracknell, is he's a retired guy, you know, and people can walk up to him and think, oh, completely harmless bloke, you know, he's not going to sell me something dodgy, and, yeah, have a chat to the guy. And if you've got people on a stand who are, you know, friendly, personable, you know, in inverted commas, normal people.
So it's important then to get CDs from Canonical to the ship it, so that you provide a professional package rather than I think it's probably more important to provide that than just a chunky thing that you made up yourself. Whilst we can do it, it's all part of the image. But
the other side of it is people appreciate that a CD costs money, especially a professionally looking one costs money to print. So you know, you could ask for a donation or have a raffle, or, you know, if it was that kind of, oh yeah, we love raffle. But in some way, finance those CDs, because they're not free, whether you're paying for them or whether Canonical are paying for them. Yeah. They're not free. Mm-hmm. They're free to the end user, but someone's got to pay for them somewhere.
Yeah. We used to charge for the CDs at the info points. People were quite happy to pay. And I think just to cover costs, and I think we charged twice as much for the Ubuntu ones, because at the time you got two CDs in there.
You did. Yeah.
And we sold more Ubuntu ones often than any of the others, because I think they look professional. £2.
Well, that's what Alan does. He actually figured out that when you try and give them away, people don't want them.
Yeah.
So he charges for them.
So they've got some kind of commitment.
They won't take them if they're free.
They assign some value to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They won't leave it on the train.
It's only £1.
Interesting, isn't it?
You know, £1, which is, what, 70 cents or something like that. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's enough. And he doesn't, like, make a huge amount of money. So it's not morally reprehensible that he's getting free CDs from Canonical and then he's charging for them. Because he actually uses the money to pay for the stand, which is, like, 20 quid or something like that.
That's what we did, yeah.
And pay for the photocopying of leaflets that he produces himself. So, you know, I don't have a problem with him, you know, making money out of it. And I don't think there should be a problem for people running stands at Fates and other community events to make money from it and put that money back into maybe making a banner or photocopying leaflets for next time and make it a sustainable thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I think somebody commented is that real geeks don't go out of the house. They, you know, send other people to do their shopping and things for them, and therefore they're never really going to get out and do this sort of advocacy. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Yeah, I think, there are a certain significant proportion of the population who are, a significant proportion of the geek population who are like that. Yeah. But I think there's enough normals out there.
Don't you? We should have a segment on that.
Yeah. What is normal? It's a good question.
There are geeks who, within our community, who feel uncomfortable doing the sales pitch, doing the, talking to complete strangers. But if someone else did the introducing and said, oh, and by the way, this guy here is responsible for doing some funky gooey stuff, and, you know, you're actually talking to the guy who wrote that, or you're talking to someone who supports people online, or you're talking to a guy who translates stuff, or whatever it is, you know, then there's some way to build a conversation for those people who maybe that's a bit difficult.
Yeah, okay. Well, what do you think? Are we advocating Ubuntu in the right places, or are we missing a trick or two here? If you want to add your two pence to the discussion, email us at podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. It's that time again where we string all the syllables together and say it's the bit about Ubuntu. Nobody contradicts me. Excellent. Right, what's first?
Ecosphere.
Shut up. What's first in the bit?
Evan Dandria has posted on the Canonical Design blog asking for support in petitioning for a new website to be set up. There's a website called Stack Exchange, and they set up support kind of websites, and you can petition them to ask them to create one tailored for whatever your platform or system is.
Your project.
Yeah. And you can go to this particular URL and press a button to say, yes, I would like that, and I'm committing to helping out by answering questions or helping out in some way on that support site.
And there's the idea of getting points and badges and things for helping out other people. I guess a little bit like Yahoo Answers, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of already have something like this.
Yeah.
Launchpad Answers.
Mm.
And it has karma. You get a reward for, you know, but this thing is an awful lot more pretty.
Right.
Which, you know,
pretty is a feature.
Pretty is good. But equally, I think the big motivation for this is that we should be sending our support people where there are people with problems.
Yeah.
So if there are people at Stack Exchange who have a problem with Ubuntu, then we mobilize our, you know, troops of support people to go there and help them fix their stuff.
Yeah, quite a few of the comments seem to be suggesting we use something called Shapado or Shapado, which is an open source alternative to that.
Yeah, it's a bit like the old should we use Twitter or Identica?
Yeah.
You know, the mass of people are on Twitter, but Identica is free software.
Yeah.
You know, what's your ultimate goal? To use free software or to address the needs of your users?
Yeah, that's a good question. But, I mean, there'll be people on both networks who need help, potentially.
Mm. And the other one already exists. The Shapado one is already there and, you know, exists, and there are some people there. But Stack Exchange exists as an entity, and there are people there who need help.
I guess it's one of these things where you just have to have as many different ways of people getting in touch with you as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some people who object to this in terms of there are already support systems. You know, we've got IRC mailing lists, forums, Launchpad Answers as the official, you know, set of support systems.
Yeah.
And why are we spreading ourselves thin across yet another one?
Yeah.
No.
You're just offering a different way of doing it.
Absolutely.
So it's, it makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And if you're the kind of person who likes Foursquare and you like collecting your little badges of, you know, achievements of you checked into so-and-so or you helped someone fix their wireless network, then, and you're helping someone who's new with Ubuntu, then great, carry on doing it.
Yeah, why not?
Because you're the kind of person who's probably not going to go to a mailing list.
It's that time in the release cycle again. The Ubuntu Free Culture Showcase has opened its doors. You've got until the end of August to submit your arty designs, photographs, and music and bits of video and stuff. And you can get included on the desktop of the live CD.
Yeah, it's all changed a bit, actually. It's rather than the way we did it before, which was have a wiki page and get people to put their content on the wiki page, we're doing the same thing that we just talked about with Stack Exchange. We're going out to the communities that have the artists and designers and going out and asking them for their content. So going to places like Vimeo, where people hang out and do their great videos, and going to Flickr, where people do great photography and other pictures, rather than getting them to come and edit some manky wiki page.
Yeah, which did get very clunky when I submitted a few ideas into it. Yeah, there were several other people, well, I guess a few dozen other people there, and the time it took to edit and render that page was enormous.
Yeah.
And very confusing as well. You couldn't easily just highlight your
Whereas if we go out to these communities and reach out to them and grab their content and ask them to contribute to us, I think we're more likely to get a significant number of decent contributions.
Yeah, but I guess there will always be those people who say, well, I'm a photographer and not on Flickr, or I don't use SoundCloud, but I do music and stuff. And
Flickr's not open source.
Yeah. I guess they lose then, really, don't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, what do you do? Yeah. I think that we could set up our own instance of something that looks a bit like Flickr, but has no users. Yeah, that would be useful.
Yeah, no, I sort of agree.
Maverick Meerkat is shaping up. We're at Alpha 2 now, I think. And we've got changes to the unified sound menu. Well, they're in a sketch form at the moment.
Yeah, so potential changes, aren't they?
Yeah. And also a suggestion that you can optionally use ButterFS. I couldn't figure out how to pronounce that. BTRFS.
I can't believe it's not
pronounced ButterFS, as in, yeah.
As in the butter.
Spreadable, yes.
The unified sound menu thing is quite an interesting idea. It gives you the option to have things like control the level of VoIP applications and other various sound sources all in one in one clickable menu. I guess it's sort of the promise of Pulse Audio being delivered, really, through a GUI. Mm. The idea of being able to control all these applications independently of each other.
Yeah, you can kind of do all of this, but in lots of separate windows and widgets here and there, but having it all unified so that you can, while you're sat at your machine and you want to mute the music that's coming out of your media center on the other side of the room because the phone's ringing, you know, you can click and mute from this little drop-down menu. Mm. Or, for example, if you wanted to, you know, mute the sound from this machine so that the Skype or Mumble or whatever your VoIP provider is can be enabled, that kind of stuff.
Which suggests that they can easily let go of the sound card for as they pass between different applications.
Yeah, that would be good if that worked.
Yeah.
So what's ButterFS then?
It's a it's Oracle thing, isn't it? Oracle
yes,
developed.
Yes, I think it came from there. Yeah.
It's a newish file system. One of the new file systems. I say new because most file systems are quite old. And you know, if it's less than about 10 years old, it's new. One of the new ones is EXT4, which we've supported for a couple of releases. And then there's ZFS from Sun, which we don't support because of licensing issues. Mm-hmm. We can't get it in the Linux kernel. But I think ButterFS is supposed to support some of the neat features that ZFS has, but it's free software and can be in the Linux kernel.
It's got distributed stuff in, I think, as well, isn't it?
And all kinds of volume management type stuff that you get with LVM and RAID and all those funky stuff. But not sure I would trust that just yet. I know it was mentioned at UDS. I think Scott James Remnant said in front of everyone it will be an install time default, and I think it was Colin Watson who kind of went no.
Will it?
And so that was very quickly retracted, and it was an install time option.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what Scott meant in the first place.
Yes, I'm sure that is. Yes, he just misread his iPhone.
Yeah.
Enterprise content management vendor Alfresco has been certified for work on the Ubuntu stack.
Mm.
Excellent.
Good. Yeah, this was announced at the Ubuntu in Business.
Oh, event. Brilliant.
Well, it was announced elsewhere, but...
it was also announced at the Ubuntu.
Yeah, from the guy from...
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
From Alfresco.
From Alfresco was there, yeah, and he announced it to everyone.
Apparently, it's the latest version, 3.3, which is certified on 10.04, the LTS server release.
Yeah.
So that could be around for a long time, potentially. Yeah.
It's a free software product that's used by, you know, large companies and small companies alike.
But it was on Solaris and Red Hat as well as Windows before, so now it's on Ubuntu, which is nice to see.
And they've got a community edition and a paid support edition as well. And so, you know, you can download the code and use it yourself on your Ubuntu system.
Cool. That's excellent.
Sens Hofstede has written an interesting blog post about how... trying to raise awareness that English speakers are privileged in IT in general, and then I think goes on to talk about Ubuntu specifically.
Hmm.
things like the fact that IT terms and functions in programming are typically in English. And then you get things like if you're in a forum and you don't type absolutely perfect English, people pick you up on your spelling and assuming that you're just a bad English typist. And yet it could be somebody's really spent a lot of time trying to construct this question and you're just sort of throwing it away and it's hard to get involved. So I think there's some really interesting points in there.
Yeah, he does some good analysis of the Ubuntu community.
Yeah, you're on there.
Yeah, I've just noticed that. Gould. But no, it's just a list of, members of the major councils in Ubuntu, the Community Council, Forum Council, IRC, Loco Council, and Technical Board, and what their country of origin and native language is.
Yeah.
And, it is predominantly English UK and English US.
Yeah, and there's a few New Zealanders and things in there as well, or Australians as well. But, basically, it's predominantly English speaking, isn't it? Which is quite disproportionate when you look at it. So it is an eye opener. He says it's not intended as a rant. It's an eye opener, not an eye slammer. Yeah, and it is an eye opener.
Yeah,
it certainly made me think a little bit about it. It would be really interesting to find out from people who are not native English speakers the experience that they've had when they've been trying to get involved in the Ubuntu community and participate in these things. If they found it difficult because their language skills are not so good in English.
I'd certainly
other
be
people.
Interested in that. One of the things we have is most of the organisation mailing lists, for example, are English, and most of the organisational IRC channels are English language. So the hash Ubuntu support channel is English. Okay, we have Ubuntu-FR for French speakers and ES for Spanish. Mm. But if someone wants to get the most number of eyeballs on their problem, they go to an English-speaking IRC channel or an English-speaking mailing list to get the most number of people potentially supporting them. And that can be a problem for them.
It's an interesting dilemma. I mean, does somebody want to divert people into helping translate or...
Well, it's not necessarily about the translations. It's about the lingua franca of the distribution itself. The language that's spoken at UDS is all English.
Yeah.
The language that's on most of the technical lists is English. And whether that predominantly leads to native English speakers being the loudest voices, if you like, on some of those forums. Sorry.
And the documentation team, ENUS is the default language. And it's up to the loco teams to translate that into other languages.
Mm.
So he's absolutely right. We are very privileged, aren't we?
Mm. Yeah. Which is good because my foreign language skills are appalling. I did count myself very lucky. Dell have put up a web page advising people how they should choose between Windows and Ubuntu, which has caused a little bit of consternation among some in the Ubuntu community. Dell have obviously been shipping Ubuntu as an option on some of their netbooks and laptops for a while now. But I guess in order to clarify for people whether they should choose Windows or Ubuntu and reduce the number of returns and things like that, they put a little guide up and it has some corking little phrases in there. Ubuntu is not a Microsoft Windows operating system, it says, fair enough, and is not compatible with Microsoft Office programs. Okay.
Which factually is true.
Not 100% compatible, okay. So it's important you make the right choice. Well, okay, yep, okay. Choose Windows if you are already using Windows programs like Microsoft Office and iTunes, etc., and want to continue using them.
How would you know if you don't want to get...
If you are familiar with Windows and you do not want to learn new programs for email, word processing, etc.
That assumes that you're using Windows only. Oops.
And the best one, you are new to using computers. Choose Windows if you are new to using computers. On the other hand, you should choose Ubuntu if you do not plan to use Microsoft Windows. Okay, fair enough. Or you are interested in open source programming.
But it sounds like they're aiming it at people who don't actually care very much.
I like the way they've got a Windows XP screenshot there.
Yes.
Rather than a Windows 7, current product. Because it's familiarity, isn't it? Oh, yeah, I recognise that. I'll go for that. It's got clouds and a green thing.
Green Teletubbies.
What's the Ubuntu one of?
Looks like netbook, some sort of netbook tweaked edition.
Do you know, that doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. I can see an Amarok picture in there and a bunch of other stuff and a load of...
It's got Minesweeper.
Okay, we're okay. That's
what you want.
Gosh.
But that is...
That's quite a shocking page, isn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, Canonical had no input whatsoever.
No. Probably not. Well, when I was at UDS, I was chatting to one of the OEM guys, and he said at Dell, they certify huge numbers of their machines to run on Ubuntu, and Canonical work very hard with them to make sure their stuff works on Ubuntu. Yeah. but it's up to each of the countries to decide which hardware they ship. So when someone complains that Dell don't sell in my country, that's totally down to Dell and the head of that region or that country who decides what selection of servers, desktops and laptops that they're going to sell. And if they choose that they don't want to sell Ubuntu in that region, then it won't be sold. It's as simple as that.
It does say at the top of the page, Dell recommends Windows 7.
Yeah, they all say that because it's part of their deal with Microsoft. But indeed, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to give a rather slanted view later on down the page.
It is incredibly frustrating. I mean, we reported a few weeks ago on the reasons you should choose Ubuntu that Dell had on their site. And it actually listed, Ubuntu doesn't get viruses. And they reworded that slightly to make it,
I know we never will, but it'd be great to understand the business model behind this, because it's got to come down to money at the end. They're not going to make as much money from selling Ubuntu systems.
Most of the licensing costs for Windows that are added onto the hardware go straight to Microsoft. So I'm not sure
much money on a Windows license.
No, exactly. Yeah.
It's very little money in a Windows license. And they also get paid to put all the crapware that you get on there, all the other stuff.
All the other add-ons.
Antivirus that gets pre-installed, the AOL dialer that gets reinstalled, and all the other rubbish that you get on there.
Do you think they've had a lot of returns of people who've been, not missold, but misled that it's cheaper or something, therefore they've got it?
We have had reports, I think, before about people who've suggesting that they've had higher return rates on Ubuntu things because people were expecting Windows.
And that must be expensive.
To say
them.
That Ubuntu is only of interest to people who are interested in programming is misleading.
And only open source programming.
Mm-hmm. And to say that Windows is entirely suitable for those who are new to using computers, whereas Alan has proven with Mumbuntu that is not necessarily the case.
My mum would disagree with that.
I think maybe you should talk to Dell.
I'll get my mum to talk to Dell.
I'm looking forward to somebody from Dell sending us an anonymous email so we can understand it and sort of tell everybody.
Yeah, or a less anonymous email and come on and explain yourselves on the show. That would be great.
Never going to happen.
Fat chance.
It could happen. Well, there we go.
There's a challenge.
That's we learned a lot about Ubuntu there. And that's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time.
It's time for some of your feedback. Alessandro Pignotti commented on the website about the last episode.
During the podcast, it's incorrectly stated that LightSpark is only for videos and is not a full Flash environment.
Oops.
LightSpark's goal is to support the most recent Flash files, versions 9 and 10, that are not supported by NASH. The current development focus is supporting YouTube first, but over time, everything will be supported.
Excellent.
A plan.
Yeah, good luck.
Meow.
I mean, it's a big project.
Yeah, it is. And it's a constantly moving, I guess not a moving target if they set the goal to be compatible with a specific set of versions of Flash, yeah.
Yeah, and several people have tried and fallen by the wayside along the years.
Hmm. Ben Thorpe sent us a long email about the article which reported that iPhone users pay for apps more than Android users.
Maybe the question is more, why do iPhone users spend so much on apps rather than why Android users spend less? Because Apple holds a tight rein on the App Store, the signal-to-noise ratio is much less, and thus people are more likely and more willing to fork out cash. The stats are probably only pulled from the Android marketplace and not other options, and a number of vendors, for instance Gameloft, are distributing paid apps through other delivery mechanisms. Equally, a number of phone providers are also bundling their own App Stores with their phones, like Orange, further muddying the waters.
You've got an Android phone, haven't you?
I have.
Have you bought any apps not from the Android marketplace?
Have you bought any apps?
No, I have bought some apps, yeah. I bought a game.
All through the marketplace?
Yeah.
Yeah, same here. I bought one app through the marketplace. Mm-hmm. In fact, I knew there were other ways to get apps. I knew you could manually install apps, but I haven't. And I've installed a few free apps manually. But personally, and I'm a techie, and I've never installed an app using, whatever Gameloft.
I think that's part of the problem. Because you're a techie, you know that you want to keep your system fairly light and you don't want it full of junk.
No, I don't think that's it. Not me personally. I mean, I've had a look at AppBrain, which is another one of these like marketplace-y things where you go to the website and you pick and choose the apps and they sync to your phone and stuff. But I've never installed a paid app through that.
I haven't got Ben's original email here, but we obviously edited it down a little bit to fit it in. He says that he's bought, I think, about 8 or 9 apps through the Android store and one app through Gameloft.
Mm.
I don't know, you've got to think the majority of them have got to be through the Android store, really.
Well, unless, as he says, the companies that provide their own store. But yeah. I'm on Orange and I don't have a...
No, I don't.
A different
either.
App store.
But then I didn't buy my phone through an Orange store, so yeah. I don't know that I've got a branded.
I don't know if that's only on certain phones or only on certain versions of Android, but mine's certainly the only store I have by default is the Android store.
So are there many free apps on the Apple store? Or they're all paid for?
There's a fair number, yeah. Oh, I mean, okay. Claire's got an iPhone 4. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, casually thinking about this the other day, how many apps has she bought? And she says she's bought a few, yeah, mm-hmm. a fair few, more than me. And she's had it 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and she's bought more, and I've had mine a year.
Has Ben got a point about the signal-to-noise ratio, though? The idea that perhaps there are better quality apps in
No, I could sit there on the Apple Store and scroll, and see nothing of vague interest.
Right, to yeah. you.
To me, but I'm a user, you know, like yeah. anyone else, you know. I don't know. Everyone has their own, like, you know, Ben has installed loads of apps, and I'm sure other people will install loads. Like, Claire has installed loads of apps, so I don't know. Yeah. These people who do surveys must know something.
Les Quarter Pounder emailed in to tell us what he does with his Joggler.
I'm currently using mine as an advert for Ubuntu at various events, including Barcamp Blackpool. This was made possible thanks to some YouTube videos created by Arthur. After learning some valuable lessons when running the Ubuntu Install Fest at OCamp 10, I realised that an advert of what Ubuntu can do would really benefit attendees. And the form factor of the Joggler, plus its powerful speakers, really draws the crowd in, especially when I show them that it's running Ubuntu Netbook Remix 9.10.
Cool.
That's rather cool, isn't it?
That's a good idea.
Yeah, we'll try and remember to put a link to that video in the show notes. He says, delegating that task to Alan.
you don't have Flash. So I wonder what kind of stuff he shows off. Does he just leave a video running? Or
I think it's basically on a little loop, and it just sort of shows the things you can do with...
and people can come over and have a play with it as well.
Yeah, and I like the idea, as you say, the form factor of the Joggler being quite eye-catching.
The only problem I have with that is that it might give a bit of a duff impression of what Ubuntu's capable of, because it's not the fastest thing in the world. And if someone went and touched a Joggler and started playing with it, and you know they didn't get a very prompt reaction, they might think, God, this is rubbish software.
Maybe it's just the video.
Yeah, maybe it's just an attractor thing to get people in, and then show them a stonking great Cray running proper desktop.
Running the spinning cube.
Mark Johnson added,
Popey mentioned the CPU being a bit weedy. Apparently, due to the cooling issues, the heatsink being consisting of a thermal pad, some plastic, and the stand, it has to throttle down to 800 megahertz as soon as you start doing anything vaguely taxing. I'm planning to replace a bit of the plastic with a metal one, like the guides on jogglerwiki.info. Hopefully that'll give it a bit more breathing space and maybe allow me to remove the sticky out bit of the stand.
The technical terms coming to the front
yes,
there.
Yes.
The jogglerwiki.info site does look quite interesting. If you've got a Joggler and feel like modding it or customising it, it's worth having a look at.
I think the community's kind of died down a little bit. The number of edits on that wiki has certainly gone down.
Is that because they've stopped selling them, I wonder?
Partly, but also because I think people have realised there's not actually a tremendous amount you can do with the Joggler.
Even this idea of replacing the heatsink does involve, it seems to involve having great big bits of metal sticking out the front and back of it, which...
attractive.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe it's useful to be able to run more than 800 megahertz on that thing.
I think there are certain mods that are useful, like take it apart and pull the Wi-Fi thing out. If you're going to use it on a wired network, because it's got a USB port on the inside, you can stick a large capacity USB stick inside it. So there are some mods that are quite useful. Mm.
Oh, is that because the wireless is a USB dongle?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Inside?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you could replace it with a different wireless dongle if you really wanted to. Yeah. I can't imagine why. Given the one that's in there fits.
Works.
And works, yeah.
On the subject of OddCamp, Alistair McKinley wrote,
you have to remember that there are 50 million people not in London. Also, for me to travel down to London, I live in Glasgow, it would cost me a lot of money and take about 13 hours on the train. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying don't do it in the South. I'm just saying don't think everyone lives there. I like the whole changing where the venue is, and I think it would be great to have one in the South, because then we could do one in Scotland another time. That'd be great.
It would be lovely to have it in anywhere in the UK.
Yeah. This was in response to somebody's email last time, saying that they thought the population of geeks in the world was in London.
Paraphrase was, more people live in the South, therefore it should be in the South.
Yeah.
Which I totally disagree with too.
Well, yeah.
The only reason that it's probably more likely to be in the South is because that's where we live and it's physically easier to plan.
Yes. I mean, there's an advantage to having somewhere someone who lives in the area where it is for very practical reasons. And Dan did a great job with that in Liverpool. We haven't discussed what may or may not happen next year, but if he's not feeling up to that workload next time around, then it will probably be somewhere closer to where we live.
I think it's safe to say it won't be in Liverpool next time around.
Okay, this happens with every community though, doesn't it? With like lugs and, you know, lug radio and any community where you're doing an event, there's always going to be people who are going to be put out and not able to get to it because it's far away or it's inconvenient or it's expensive or for whatever reason.
But the thing is, what are we providing? You know, anybody can organise an event. If you want one in Glasgow, organise one in Glasgow.
Absolutely.
I will come to Glasgow.
Yep.
No, I think we all
I'll come as well if you pay my travel.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to fly.
But that is a problem. When you're organising these events and you get emails from people who, you know, I'm not saying specifically Alistair, but, you know, you get emails from people having, you know, a bit of a pop because of the location you're organising it, yet some of these people don't actually turn up or, you know, drop you an email the day before and say, oh, actually, I can't make it for whatever reason. You know, there's genuine reasons not to be able to turn up. But for, you know, it's sending an email from the armchair. Oh, I think you should do it in this location and then not turn up is kind of irritating or not actually help organize it in that location. Yeah. You know, the fact is someone's got to organize it.
Yep.
Anton Piatek asks,
have you thought about doing a help wanted segment? I know Debian send out the Help Wanted section in some of their mailing list regular posts, mostly talking about packaging, translating, upgrade testing help. There must be similar things going around Ubuntu, and perhaps some of these are something that an average listener could help with if only they knew that help was wanted in that area.
What, specific help in a particular package or something, or just in general, we need translators or...
Possibly.
A help email list, specifically help. Obviously, the Ubuntu UK forums are chocker and some would say not particularly useful or helpful. So an Ubuntu UK help email list and it's just about help.
But would you want to subscribe to a thing that's just constant people going, help me, help me?
But doesn't he mean on the podcast?
I think he does, yes.
I think so. But we're always happy to kind of mention projects and stuff.
Yeah, totally. So if people have help that they want to, you know, need and they want us to announce it. I'm not sure that we're the best people to deliver that kind of message. I don't know.
Well, we can pass it on.
Yeah, sure, we can. But I don't know if we reach. I don't know if we reach the right people. Do we?
Saves trying to find other content.
Very true.
It'll make a nice interview, at least.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Speaking of generating content, if you have any feedback for us, send us an email: podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Now, before we finish the feedback, Alan has been.
Oh, yes.
Poking around, looking for some praise for himself on the internet.
That's not fair.
It's marginally true. And in doing so, found out that we have lots of feedback on iTunes. Now, Alan being the only Mac user, is the only person who checks iTunes.
You do realise that iTunes runs on Windows as well. And it can run in...
Out of the four of us here...
Who's running Windows?
You're the only person who runs iTunes.
Okay.
I think I'm right saying, so that's what I meant.
You can run it, though.
I could if I... Yeah, fair enough. But I don't. So, out of the four of us here who does run iTunes, Alan is the one who can look at the feedback, and he found some feedback, and it was...
Overall, positive.
Good, that's nice.
Good.
Yes.
How many stars do we get? They do a star rating.
It varies, actually, and I didn't record that.
Okay. it was mostly fours,
it was all either fours or fives.
Fours or fives, wow. Excellent.
Yeah.
We had some little comments, didn't
Should
we?
I give you some?
Yeah, go on then.
Some of these? And these are not in any particular order. We had someone called True Boy say, great listen, always looking out for the next release, well produced and kept lighthearted without missing the point. Good work.
Oh, that's very good.
Thank you very much.
Somebody called Fizzy Chicken, that's Fizzy Chicken, says a very well put together podcast, entertaining and insightful hosts, recommended. I like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fizzy Chicken.
Lee194 said, would recommend to anyone who wants to learn more about Ubuntu.
Joff_com. They're not made for reading out, are they? Anyone who uses Ubuntu should give this a listen to. You will learn a lot more, and it's funny as well.
Dave1022, friend of the show, says, very good podcast done with a great bunch of guys and Laura. Whether you're an Ubuntu newbie or a command line power user, you'll love this cast. Thank you, Dave.
That's guys in the androgynous sense, I think. Somebody called...
Speak for yourself.
I mean, the general sense.
Yes, that's right.
Somebody called Tux Lover says, great stuff, funny and info. Thanks, guys.
And Laura.
Aside. And Laura.
Fishley simply says, cool.
Excellent.
Thanks, Fishley.
And Tifar says, great podcast. I like the content and the interviews. Very informative and funny as well. Keep up the good work.
So if you're a user of iTunes, then feel free to leave us a comment. And,
nice one, especially.
Well, it's fine. Positive and negative, you know, we welcome all kinds of feedback. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook, IRC channels, everything you need to know. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Have a week.